And now we're going to introduce you to some people whose families have been in the Valley for about a century. Moderator Kathleen Schock talks to two longtime Fresnans, Doritha Williams and Ann Lopez Gaston, about the obstacles their families faced and the hard work that allowed later generations to prosper. They're joined by historian Michael Eisinger.
So thank you all for being here. Just by way of introduction, I'm going to go around and introduce all the members of our conversation today, starting with Dr. Michael Eisinger. Thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
And tell us a little bit about your work.
For the last almost 12 years, I've been researching the simple term I've come up with for it is historically rural African-American settlements. I know that's a big, long term to say that there have been in the history beginning in the 1880s and up through the 1960s at least two dozen all or majority black communities out on the landscape, whether it's colonies like Allensworth and Bowles, or whether it's unincorporated towns like Fairmead and South Dos Palos, or it's unincorporated neighborhoods like Home Acres or Sunny Home Gardens or Sunny Acres, and this is the one that's the hardest to track down, and I'm sure I'm missing two-thirds of them, and that's black labor camps.
Great.
And they're all over the valley. So that's and then how these communities fare today and those types of things. That's what I've been working on.
Wonderful. Well, we'll get to all of that in just a minute. Also with us today are Doritha Cooley Williams. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for asking me.
And also with us is Ann Lopez Gaston. Ann, tell us a little
bit
about your family's story and how your family came to call the Central Valley home.
Well, it begins with migration coming in from either the Cape Verdes Islands or the Azores. The family, we would get stories from two sides, Azores or the Cape Verdes. They were islands that were Portuguese and African descendants. John Lopes, which was the Portuguese African, met a lady that was from Australia. She was mixed blood. They could not live in Australia, so they had to leave Australia, and that's when they took the ship and came over to America.
And then who was your first ancestor to live here in the Central Valley?
To my knowledge, it would be John Lopes, and I have a picture of him.
And one of her relatives lived across the street from me, and he resembled an Indian, long gray straight hair, and he was a horseman. His wife was a member of our church, which was right across the street.
So Doritha, now that you've chimed in, tell us about your earliest ancestors to settle here in the Central Valley.
Oh, it was in the 20s.
And what brought them here?
They were from Mississippi. They had witnessed lynchings and so forth. But my dad's great aunt was the first one that I knew of. And she came because, and I've told them the story, she came because she had to flee for her life. She ran kind of a honky-tonk cafe in Mississippi, but the food was good, so a number of white patrons would come and eat. And my dad, who was 10 or younger, was there, and he was asked to dance. Well, he couldn't dance because his brother had put him in the fireplace, and three of his toes had burned when he was an infant. So he walked with a limp, but he was asked to dance. And he didn't say anything to this man. And the man said, "I told you to dance," and shot him in the very ankle of the foot, that left one. And when he did that, my great aunt, who always, you know, women wore those long aprons, she shot him.
What a phenomenal story.
We don't know to this day whether he lived or died because they had to leave right then. They were in Laurel, Mississippi. and they had to leave right then. Well, they went to Louisiana, I understand, and they stayed there for about 6 weeks, maybe 2 months. But the word got out where they were, so then they came to California.
That is remarkable. So that migratory path from the South out to the West, Michael, can you speak a little bit to how common that was?
It's extremely common, and it comes in three different waves. The first one being in the 1880s during the Chinese exclusionary period, where they're trying to get rid of the Chinese and bring in other labor. When we look at our fields, we always just expect that whoever picks our crops is going to be probably undocumented and Hispanic. But we've had Japanese field crews, had Filipino film crew, or work crews. There was a time when the most sought after was African Americans. At two different times and for two different reasons. So in the 1880s, 1884, Butler Farms here in Fresno is one of the two, one of the very first two, without being in Kern County, that are actually recruiting African Americans from the South. And they send back recruiters. They put in ads in newspapers all over the country. They bring back boxcars full of workers. They don't bring the 30,000 that they're looking for, but they bring back a significant number. The next big wave happens in the 1920s. And the majority of the families that I can locate today came here in the 1920s. In Fowler, the first four churches, two of them were African-American churches. South Coast Palace, the first black residents there were in the 1920s. Fairmead, the first black residents were in the 20s. So there was a wave that came in the 20s. And then the Dust Bowl in World War II and the immediate aftermath is the third big wave. And so during the Dust Bowl, you have the Black Okies. Every Black History Month, you'll see in the Bakersfield, California, a Black Okie story. Mark Arax, who I work with a lot, always refers to all the black migrants as Black Okies, even though it's not an accurate term, but it does lump it together in that period. And they are coming for the Dust Bowl. Then they come out to work in the shipyards and airplane factories and other factories in California in the urban areas. And at the end of the war, many of these families didn't want to go back to Mississippi or Arkansas or Texas or Oklahoma, where the Klan was ascended immediately after the war.
Plus, they couldn't get jobs.
And there weren't jobs. So many of these people that had come out here to work in the factories during the war pooled their money. And so Cooksyville, outside of Atwater, was a family compound of 150 people, bigger than Allensworth ever was and lasted longer, but there's no state park to it, right? Mm-hmm. The Williams family came into Fairmead and at one time owned the largest dairy in the state of California, the only black-owned dairy and the largest one in the state. Wow. And we see the same in Teveston and the Matheny Tract and all this, that after the war, we have a lot of people who were rural people who came out to work in urban areas and they didn't want to stay in Oakland or Baldwin Hills or some of those neighborhoods, and so they came here. And one of the reasons why so many of them ended up on the landscape was because at the time, it was very difficult for African Americans to get loans for property, mm-hmm. whether it's a home or a farm. Mm-hmm. And in most of these little towns that I write about, Fairmead, South Dos Palos, Glenair, Matheny Tract, Teveston, Alkali, there were white individuals who purchased large blocks of land and then sold them by carrying the contracts themselves. And there's some great stories with those. So that African Americans could purchase land in Lanier and in Fairmead, and that's how they got that's how they actually got property at a time when it was almost impossible for people to get that.
That's actually a story that I've had about my family because my father came out when he was 4 years old from St. Louis to Kalwa because he had a relative who owned land there and they were able to live on that property. Mm-hmm. I was always sort of struck with what my ancestors must have gone through to be able to purchase land in the valley. I'm wondering, and do you have, you're nodding your head.
Well, I know my great-grandmother, she left Jonesboro, Georgia.
Could be.
In the early, it would be the late 1800s, came by covered wagon. Her husband was already in Fresno. He was a blacksmith. And his name was Henry, so he had already had established a business. So he sent for her, and on that same covered wagon was Doritha's grandmother or aunt.
Aunt, great aunt.
And then I think the Ellards. the Ellerts, which would be Henry Ellert, the football player, his descendants, they were all in covered wagons, and they came out from Georgia to California. And I'm like, I'm trying to get in my mind, how did they do this? You know, that had to have been a horrific travel.
It's really a testament to their resiliency to make it.
Conditions of the roads, and then also because of the color of their skin, there's no telling what they might have ran across, but they made it to California. Yeah,
there was no green book in the
1880s. Yeah, you know, so I don't know what routes they took, but I just know that they came here by covered wagon. It was because my grandmother, which was her daughter at the time, was five. And then her brother, Walter, was probably about seven. I think it was a couple, 2 or 3 years difference in their ages.
And what can you say about those early days for your family in the Central Valley? Was it an easy path for them to make their mark here?
Well, my great-grandmother, I heard a lot of stories about her. And she did live till I was about 12, so I got to see her in action. But she was a very, very, I guess, a trailblazer, pioneer type woman. She was an entrepreneur. She actually had started businesses within the city of Fresno. They bought property out on, say, 99 Shields in that area. She had a big ranch out there. And I remember going out there as a kid. Although she had moved into the city, but the property was still there. And the family sold it. And my great uncle, which was her youngest son, lived to be 100, almost 101. He used to tell me, Ann, every time I go down 99, I look over at Shields and McKinley, I cry because I know there's money on that property somewhere. Because she would bury money.
Oh, my heaven. Oh,
wow. You know, she would bury money.
You guys need to take a guy and go out there.
And I told Rick, I said, whoever bought that property probably came across a lot of money because she didn't believe in banks.
Yes.
You know,
they would bury.
And sometimes I told Rick, I said, you know, that's not a bad idea to just take stuff and bury, but you have to have someone.
You have to remember where it's at.
But,
so, Doritha, tell us a little bit about your experience, your family's experiences when they first came out here.
Well, the only thing I know is that this great aunt, and her husband bought land. And then they bought land. And then they bought land. Now, when they came, the only thing available for him was yard work. And so he took a lot of young boys and amassed money. And my great aunt saved, I don't know, she had about a quarter of a block of land, corner land, that's there today. And she grew everything that they ate. She grew everything, chickens, a few ducks, but all of the vegetables, you know, and she lived that way. Her nephew, my dad, and his two brothers, the two brothers had fought in the war. William, the oldest one that put him, my dad, in the fireplace, had lived after the war and had come to California to be with the aunt because Doritha, after my dad's sister, and his mother and father all died of tuberculosis.
Oh, goodness. Mm.
And my dad had tuberculosis when he was a young man, and they put him in a lean-to outside of the house, and that's where he slept and stayed. And they brought food to him, and it was like chicken mesh or whatever you call that,
chicken.
Right. On the sides to keep animals from coming in. But he stayed there until he was cured.
So my family in Kalwa, lived in what was essentially a tent for most of my father's childhood. He mm-hmm. lived there with his six siblings and worked in the fields, of course, while also going to school. I'm understanding, as I look at the history, that those kind of conditions were actually fairly common for African Americans living in the Valley at that
time. Oh, yes. Except that, remember, we couldn't put our money in the bank, so our money was always readily available to us. My aunt would have been hung had they not had enough money to leave immediately after she shopped the gym.
Michael, can you speak a little bit to the conditions within the camps?
Yeah, and it doesn't change between the 1880s and the 1960s. Essentially, they are pretty primitive. The work camps, especially, if there are, I mean, you can still see a few remnants along the sides of some of the county roads of these just small little shacks. If you haven't had a chance, up until last month at the Fresno Art Museum, and it's now on exhibit up at UC Merced, there are the photographs of Ernest Lowe, who came through in 1961, 62, and 64, and took amazing photographs in a number of communities. The total collection is over 10,000 photographs of African Americans working the fields of the Central Valley. He also has a similar collection of Hispanics and of Filipinos and White Okies doing the same thing. But this is 1961 through 64, and yet the photographs that he produced, you couldn't tell if they were from Dorothea Lange's period in the 30s or whether they were from the 1870s, because these are tar paper shacks. Many cases I know people I've interviewed in Fairmead and the Delano labor camp, they were in tents. They were in wooden frames with literally nothing but tar paper and maybe some wood over it. Very, very primitive. There were still, in the 80s and 90s, there were still African Americans out in the Tulare Lake Basin who had neither running water nor electricity. There are still, you get out of the cities, the rural poverty among the African American community is all over the place. And, just go to Teveston and drive around. Half of those buildings you think are abandoned, there are people still living in them. Mm. I often put up I'll start my talk this way out. I'm speaking on the 28th, I think it is, up at Merced College. And I always start the talk off with a picture of these people standing in a field. And I go, where is this? And they say Mississippi. And I say Madera. And then everybody's freaked out because the next picture I ask the same question. And they go, and it was Pixley. So it's, we can get into a whole heavy discussion about how we make the memory fit our present. And so forgetting that blacks are in the field, we're in the fields for essentially almost 80 years, picking cotton, which was one of the primary crops of the valley, that does make us look like and feel like Mississippi. And when you mm-hmm. look at these conditions, incongruity in most people's brains when you show them how these people were living within my lifetime, within all mm-hmm. of our lifetimes, mm-hmm. Living in these conditions, some of them still there, it doesn't register. How can that be? That's the Deep South. That's not California. That's not this progressive place that we love so much.
But we have to understand, this is an agricultural valley, and the entire valley. People who come because they want to work and make money. Many of the Hispanics mm-hmm. would send their money back to mm-hmm. Mexico, back to Cuba, back to wherever, because what a lot of people fail to realize is that Hispanola mm-hmm. was everything between South America and North America.
You mean Nueva España?
Yes.
Yeah, New Spain. Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah, I ask my students what happened here in 1775, and they start telling me about stuff that happened in Concord and Boston. I'm saying, no, what happened here in 1775? Because it doesn't dawn on them that because we don't study Spanish history or Mexican history,
that's
and yet
right.
that's the history
that's
of where
right.
we live. And
but
so this history is also we just ignore it.
Well, Fresno, I have to give Fresno credit. My parents taught black history when they taught adult education and most of the Italians and a few German, but most Italians were the ones whom they taught. In fact, at my mother's funeral, there were more Italians than there were blacks.
Well, but I want to get back to the point you made about agriculture really being the defining thing that brought people to this region.
That's right.
And it was so many of the stories that I've been able to go back and read have been stories of blacks in the South who were working as sharecroppers, who saw this region of California as a place to leverage their skills and experience in a way that will allow them to break the bondage of, mm-hmm. of sharecropping. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if... Do you know, have you been able to find those stories in your research, Michael?
There are a bunch of them. Mark Arax mm-hmm. writes about a guy named Robert Parker. Robert Parker was one of probably about a dozen, I guess we call them transporters. He made 40 trips between here and North Texas and Oklahoma, rounding up people who wanted to abandon their sharecrops. He worked for a guy, a labor recruiter, who had a brother who was a sheriff back in Oklahoma. And the sheriff would go around to the sharecroppers and say, look, if you want to get out of this mess, because what people understand with the sharecrop is that when great-grandfather got on the land, he didn't have any money, so he borrowed money from the landowner to get the seed and the plow and all that stuff. Then he paid his share plus what of the debt he could was probably more than he made. Mm-hmm. And so then the debt would continue and it would accrue each
That's
and every
right.
year.
It was
until
another form of slavery.
Exactly. And it was cheaper for them than slavery was. And so by the time we get to the 1950s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, there are a lot of people that want to get away from it. And there's no computerized databases, no, you know, Better Business Bureau in the level that we think of today. And so if you could get, like you're the one who shot somebody, wanted to get away from
had to get away.
You had to get away. You could do this. And so he would go around and he would, on prearranged times, and he would pick people up under bridges and on the sides of fields. And he was just one of many. And they brought, he made 40 trips. He had a school bus. Bought an old school bus, and that's what he used it. And there were others that used flatbeds with benches on the back, so people would make the trip from Mississippi riding in an open flatbed the whole way just to get here. So it isn't just covered wagons that made it difficult. Many of the people that came under the most insane conditions, but they got here. And initially, they came for free, and they were essentially indentured servants. Mm-hmm. And so in the 1880s, 1890s, there were white guys on horses riding around the valley looking for runaway blacks.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
that's
you
right.
can't get any more Southern
that's
than
right.
than looking wow. for people who ran away.
That's
Within
right.
a few years, they decided it was easier, because what happened was they were offering 50% of the pay that they were offering whites and that the Chinese had been getting when they're trying to get rid of the Chinese and bring these black workers in. And so people would come out here and they would realize they were getting ripped off. And most of the people, what people don't understand is slaves had skills. There were some, I mean, even picking cotton is a skilled labor, but many slaves worked in construction. They worked in packing houses and in, not packing houses, but the plantation version of it. They could mm-hmm. process meat, they could butcher, they could, mm-hmm. could. So they had lots and lots of skills. And so they would come out here, and when they were essentially owing the company the transportation, they were essentially indentured servants. So the first blacks that came out at that point really kind of were just trading one kind of slavery for another. Then they decided it was cheaper just to charge them. It was easier. That way, if they got out here and decided they didn't want to work for the labor recruiter, they could find work elsewhere. They could. But many of the stories that you hear, whether it's the Delano or the Stratford or Strathmore or the many of these labor camps, there were six of them outside of Pixley. The conditions are horrible. They came in these large numbers, and they're a huge part of our history that just doesn't exist until people like the four of us start screaming about it and going, hey, they're here.
Mm-hmm. Which really leads me to, and I wish we had more time, I could talk about this forever, but before we wrap up, I would love to hear from all of you about why this history matters. I mean, these are conversations that are not largely had in schools in the Valley or among groups outside of the African American community. And Anne, we'll start with you. Why is it important to hold on to these stories? What does it mean to people today?
If you have no history, then you cannot go forward. Like going back to my forefathers that came here, and then my great-grandmother She actually had a business where she had a boarding house, and then she also had a sanitation business. And my dad, his brother and cousin, they ran the trucks. So it's like they were in high school, but they were driving trucks for her. Eventually, she lost the business, and it went to the Gabriel family, and then from the Gabriel family went to BFI.
But that's a proud history to pass down to to the next generation. It's important to know that there's so many stories of success.
And then my Ed Lopes was the one that we were talking about earlier. He worked with Mr. Fancher, Senior Fancher of the Underground Gardens.
Yes.
I was told, and nothing's written down, that he actually helped build that underground garden with old man Fancher. Nothing's written, so it's like as you could call it maybe folklore, but you can pass that on. And it gives our kids a sign of stability that they can be. You can do whatever you want once you put your mind forward, no matter what the circumstances are. And when I see what they had to go through and what I might be going through now, I'm just like a chip off the old block, because they set it. You know, they set the pace.
Absolutely. Sure. Yeah, the contributions of Blacks in the Valley were so instrumental to creating this community. Mm-hmm. Doretha, why do you think this history matters?
Oh, I know it matters. Because you have to have some stimulus to let you know you can get over. Blacks have come a long way. We have a lot to do yet, but we've come a long way, a long, long way. And knowing your history gives you the impetus to do it yourself.
Well, I can't think of it's a perfect way to end this conversation. We certainly have seen a lot of growth in this region, and it's. I really appreciate you all taking the time to really document the incredible contributions that African Americans have made.
Thank you.
Thank you.